we also have to, I think we have to frame it around the question of well-being. As important as the issue of doctors taking their lives is, we have to sort of tip it around, and how do we have well-functioning doctors whose well-being is looked after, and they're looked after their well-being? How do we get systems that are more humane? How do we get out, reduce some of the hierarchical administrative aspects which make people often forget the reasons they've gone in to being a doctor, in terms of wanting to help others and wanting to learn and contribute. So I'm, even though we meet doctors who are struggling, my focus and the team's focus is still to speak of well-being.
Are you a health professional wanting to explore all the options life has to offer? Then you've come to the right place. The Balanced Medics Handover podcast is all about living outside the box of what we've been told. I'm Isabella, your host, a junior doctor from Australia and trained coach. I'll be interviewing health professionals from all walks of life, artists, authors, non-clinical specialists, and more. These stories show that our choices are endless. Let's take the journey together. This is The Handover. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Handover. This episode, we have Dr. Patrick Johnson on. He is a psychiatrist, psychotherapist, educator, and the medical director of the Victorian Doctors Health Program. He's on today to speak about a tough topic, physician suicide and physician mental health, and I'm so grateful to have him on to share his wisdom and experience. Hi, Patrick. How are you?
I'm well. And yourself, Isabella?
Yeah, I'm good too. Thanks for asking. Now, I like to start every episode similarly. Can you share your journey and how you got to where you are now? I know it's tough to summarize, but just so people know how you did
get there. I often ask myself that question too. You know, when a lot of living life is in retrospect. You know, you work out where you've ended up by thinking backwards to some extent. So I've never been a great planner. I've often just taken opportunities when they've come up. So I guess the thing that led me to becoming the director of Victorian Doctors Health Program was that I'd been the medical director of a CAM service, of a regional CAM service, for a good 10 years. And I was looking for more leadership opportunities, and I'd done a lot of work with registrars and junior doctors and other staff groups through the hospital. And I recognised that a lot of them were interested in, you know, what psychiatry might have to offer for how their unit was running, or how they were coping their own life. People would come up and ask me questions. I was there for so long that senior doctors would ring me up and say, oh, look, I'm worried about my daughter, or I'm worried about my son. And so I recognised that there was that need for our medical staff to sort of, you know, have something they could approach. And so that led me really to the VDHP.
Yeah, and what about medicine? What drew you to medicine in the first place?
I think that's probably coming from an Irish working class Catholic family of migrants. I either had a choice of priest or a doctor. I thought a doctor. I wasn't going to do the first one. I was from that era where my family didn't know much about university. No one had ever been before, and it was seen as medicine was seen as a very, you know, highly recognized and valued profession. My family, all of them were nurses. Actually, my mum and my aunts were all nurses, so I grew up knowing about hospitals and them talking about the work they were doing and seeing how much they valued the work they did. And I was lucky enough in those days that to sneak past the post and get into Monash University.
Yeah, so in another life, maybe you'd be a Catholic priest.
No, I don't think so. I think you can edit that piece out, Isabella.
All right, I'll leave that one out.
No, I'm just joking. You can leave that in if you want. But the point about that is we all have different reasons why we get into medicine, and usually it's a nest of threads. You know, I do meet people who have one particular thread or one particular focus or idea, and whilst I admire that, that can also be problematic if that sort of idea doesn't come true. So right. I guess I feel I'm lucky that a whole host of ideas led me to doing medicine. I think Chekhov was a doctor, and that influenced me too. So all these weird little ideas lead you to ticking that box.
Mm. Yeah. It's always interesting to hear people's reasoning behind why they go into medicine.
I could also, I could also cleave off the more sort of more noble ideas, you know, the wish to help others, the love of that type of knowledge. It depends where you put your lens, but they're all sort of true in some way.
Yeah, and in psychiatry, because I read that you were in ED at some point as an emergency medicine specialist.
Yes,
I
did 4 years of medical work in various positions before I started my psychiatry trainings, and so you're sort of a bit more freer to do that, I think, once upon a time. Though I'd still advise if you wish to not take a straight and narrow path. And I did quite a bit of work in emergency, and I just had this fantasy of adventuring. I quite like walking up tall mountains, and so I had that sort of idea that I'd have those emergency skills. I'm not saying I didn't, but I never got them ingrained enough, and I found I preferred talking to patients. I was working in intensive care, and, it was hard work. But I nevertheless found myself talking to the relatives, and I felt I had something to offer there.
Yeah. So you went to a more speaking with the patients, specialty psychiatry, and what about doctor's health? What piqued your interest in that?
You know, it's both personal, professional. You know, all doctors have a question of their health as they go through their career. I don't think anyone escapes unscathed, or no one has a period in their life where they don't suffer or struggle in some way. And I certainly had mine. Mine was probably my hardest time was probably pre-fellowship. They were very tough years, and that stayed with me to a great degree, and it gave me sort of an empathy for the junior doctors I saw coming through. And I think it allowed me not to look past the different struggles they had. And sometimes as a director of a service, I had to make decisions which weren't particularly pleasant for some of the junior doctors and staffing. And that was a puzzle to me as well, because I was concerned for them at a personal and professional level, but I still had to make decisions which sometimes were more institutionally based, and institutions, as much as the people are good, institutions themselves don't really have a heart, and that's often hard. So I enjoyed education, as you can see. I enjoy talking, and I've got to be careful. I enjoy talking, and I enjoy talking to even my peers in pediatrics or emergency about their work and how they're coping. And so I just felt I had something to contribute. And when the opportunity came up, I jumped at that.
Yeah, thanks for sharing your own personal story, because it is very vulnerable to share that. And I know it's not often the case that people feel they can share how they struggled in medicine, but it is very common.
Yeah, exactly. And look, it's also it's a question of how much to share as well. I tend to operate on the side of just giving a sense that I've been in that space rather than going into details. And where others you really work that space well and contribute a lot by us knowing a lot of the specifics of their story. So I just that's important for everyone. You just work out, you know, where you position yourself and how much you need to disclose or how much you speak from that spot. But I think carrying it in the back of my head and understanding that I know what it's like to be in a dark place for a long period of time, I find that that's very helpful, that I know that inside.
Yeah, yeah. Can you help the listeners understand the scope of Dr. Suicide? Because it is a topic that's not often spoken about, but it is there.
Absolutely. I think it's a very serious issue, and it's been well recognised for a long period of time that doctors take their lives. And that doesn't mean we're discounting that other health professionals don't as well. And each profession has to think about what's happening for their professional group. So I think it's really important that we don't discount our colleagues in allied health and nursing and our ambulance colleagues and paramedics as well. So across the health profession, suicide is a significant problem. I think, you know, in Australia, if I crunch the numbers right, it might be about 6 doctors a year, something along those lines, take their lives. And that's 6 doctors too many. And then there's the doctors who don't and the doctors who think about it. So these are the ones where we wish we had done a lot more and which we were more available for. And I guess that's why this service is set up, and why we have an easy path to access, you know, a colleague like myself to talk to. And we try to make it as least bureaucratic as possible, so those doctors who find it hard to pick up the phone don't hang up the phone when they do pick it up. You've got to make it really accessible. So I think every state, you know, each year has a doctor who may take their life. And sometimes we have clusters as well. You know, there was one a few years ago, not that they knew each other, but there was a couple of deaths in a row, which really shakes the whole profession and it shakes the service they're working in and their patients and that doctor's family. So the ramifications are quite significant because of the role that that doctor plays in that community. And some, you know, it's heartbreaking when it's a junior doctor who has set their sights on helping others. So there's something of that. And then it's heartbreaking when it's an experienced doctor who, you know, we feel must have carried too much and got to the point of carrying that burden for their community. So I think it's just not a numerical thing. It's the question of, you know, we understand that it's a helping profession and therefore it hits a bit harder for the community and for that person's family.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And what puts people most at risk of suicide? What factors contribute to increase this risk?
I think being isolated, and that can be isolated in lack of friendships and lack of peers. And you don't have to be in an isolated area to be isolated. You can be in the middle of the city and feel very lonely. It's very possible. And so that's a really warning bell for anyone's well-being when they feel lonely and isolated and when they don't have someone to speak and talk to. And I know that from my own work as a psychotherapist, that loneliness is a significant question that people bring, and particularly the doctors I see and medical students I see, they bring that question. So I think loneliness is a significant thing. I think after a while, expectations and demands that can feel quite heavy with one's own sort of pressures to perform well, and then a sense of shame when you're not. So loneliness and shame, I think, are two ingredients. The question of whether it tips into sort of a depression proper, you know, there's that argument, are all suicides depression proper? And if they had been treated for depression in sort of a medical model, would that have sort of helped? And I think there's something in that. So a lot of loneliness and isolation can tip into more than unhappiness, it tips into a depression. And I think of depression as when the word depressed, when you can no longer carry your suffering, because we all suffer, But it's when you can't carry your suffering anymore, and your body starts to struggle, your mind races, you feel tired, you can't get out of bed. But there's this little sense of the body being weighed down by one's suffering. And you hear doctors saying that, don't you? They feel ashamed, they're in emergency, and they feel really depressed, and yet the person in front of them is telling them a horrible, horrible story of their terrible life. And you're thinking, I shouldn't be depressed. I shouldn't be depressed. You know, this person, or you go up to the ward and you see an elderly gentleman with a respiratory disease, or you know, his life is ending, and they're more cheerful than you are.
Yeah, maybe.
It really is. It really is very hard to leave those sorts of wards and feel on top of things when, you know, you see death around you, and yet, you know, and you can't carry your own struggles. It's very hard. It's very confusing.
Yeah, and you touch on a really important point with that. You can shame yourself for what you are feeling and try to push it away and maybe not face it.
Yeah, shame is a circular thing. Shame leads back on itself like guilt. Guilt is very different from owning up to something and say, you know, that was my mistake. This is what I will now do. Guilt and shame sort of keep the circuit going. Shame wants you to hide, and then hiding makes you feel shamed. Mm. And it just builds on itself. And the thing about shame is it's also has a built-in idea of wanting to disappear. So. Yeah. Where depression in some ways, melancholy people often, yes, they do want to sort of withdraw back, but if you can bring them into speaking about their life and their story, that's very powerful. But shame, I think shame with anxiety is a problem, because anxiety you can't really talk about. You can't give a story about being anxious. You can just speak about your slip-ups and your mistakes. Where with your unhappy, you can talk about my boyfriend, my girlfriend, my mum, my dad, my friend, this happened, that happened. Anxiety is it's really hard to build a narrative around often.
Yeah.
I'm throwing out some loose ideas, Isabel. No, I haven't formulated them very well, but the phenomenology is of interest to me rather than to try and think through for that particular person how their different sense of themselves leads to this isolation and leads to, you know, terrible decisions sometimes.
Yeah, it is interesting because I think that's in the back of a lot of people's mind, at least mine, is the why, you know, trying to figure out everything that leads up to that event. And shame and guilt are, I think, are quite rampant in a lot of physicians. You know, if you make a medical error, or maybe just you do everything right and it's not a good outcome, you can start getting in that loop of shame, guilt.
Yes. I mean, in my I still do some work in the child and youth mental health space, and unfortunately, as a director of a service, we had young people take their lives, and I had to, who I knew, and I had to, you know, speak with their families, and it's terrible for their family and for the community. But a lot of the time, those young people, just everything wrong lined up on one day. And if they hadn't done that event on that day, they may not have taken their life. So the majority that I was involved with, just terribly certain things lined up on one day. But for the doctors that I've involved with who have taken their lives, or that I've known of, it seems to have been more an idea they've carried with them in a more decisive way. Will I or won't I? That's what's a bit more frightening about it is for health professionals, doctors included, there's often a sort of a drive to do that, and people, they're keeping it at bay for some time. They're walking around thinking about it. They might avoid certain things because they know that that's something that they could hurt themselves in some way, or that they have these visions of it. And so there's a lot of avoidant behavior as well. So I think that's the slightly different phenomena for health professionals, is there's often a much more sense that this was, as terrible as it sounds, a decision in some way that they're going to end their life.
Right. Not an impulsive one. It's more of a,
it's got less of the impulsiveness, I think.
Yeah.
Not the final decision. Maybe not that final point, but prior to that, there often seems to be a lot more cogitation and thinking about it, and than in other groups that I've been involved with. So not all. Yeah, these are generalizations, yes. Really, of course.
Yeah. Hopefully that's scope to prevent and scope to intervene as well. Then if it's a prolonged holding of ideas.
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot one can do. And I think understanding it is important, and there's a lot that you can do. Not every doctor who approaches us has dark thoughts, but many do, and we can really help them. And I think professional help is important. Peer relationships are important. Our friends are important, but there is help available. I mean, we see about 250 doctors a year. We have another sort of 50 or 60 of that go on to the next year in some form. We may see some every month or every 3 months, and we make sure they're tied into good clinical care. So we sort of walk alongside that. We don't diagnose. We don't prescribe. And that keeps us out of being, caught up in sort of any bureaucratic or administrative duties or legal stuff, and so the doctors know that they can speak to us, and we're here as an advisory service. And I think that's important, to have that colleague that they can go to and say, look, this has now happened. I've got back to work. I'm still not feeling that robust. I'm doing 3 sessions a week. What do you think is the next step? Is there something I should do with administration, or should I go back to my medical defense? And we'll just talk it through like a colleague who's got a bit of experience, because we've talked to other doctors who've been in those settings. So we take it very, very much along that approach.
Yeah, and it's great that the Doctors Health Program exists in all the states and territories, because it is that impartial, confidential. Don't need to worry about your employer finding out if you call up, things like that.
Absolutely, and also because the teams are doctor led.
Yeah,
not all my staff are doctors, but one of our staff has been working with doctors for over 23 years. I think she's worked with more, our psychologist has worked with more doctors than anyone in Australia.
Wow.
You know, 23 years. And our other staff who aren't medically, we work together as a team. So we've got some great doctors on our staff, and hopefully led well.
Yeah. I think so.
Thank you.
Yeah. And can you, I think, since we're on the lines of prevention and what we can do, can you share some warning signs that we might have of colleagues, families, friends to look out for?
Look, I think so. And I think prevention, I think we also have to move to well-being.
Mm.
I think for me, the conversation, I get the conversation today was framed around Dr. Suicide, and I think – and I often do get asked about that, but we also have to frame it around the question of well-being, as important as the issue of doctors taking their lives is. We have to sort of tip it around, and how do we have well-functioning doctors whose well-being is looked after, and they're looked after their well-being? How do we get systems that are more humane? How do we reduce some of the hierarchical administrative aspects which make people often forget the reasons they've gone in to being a doctor, in terms of wanting to help others and wanting to learn and contribute. So I'm even though we meet doctors who are struggling, my focus and the team's focus is still to speak of well-being and to approach from there. And you'll find in the literature in Doctors Health, it's moved from this question of resilience 20 years ago to well-being, and that it's everyone's responsibility. And I've got to try and remember the question. How can we help others?
If someone's struggling we help each other?
Yeah, well, I think it is starts where in what I said, we have to have leadership and well-being, and that allows us to see others are struggling. If, you know, it allows us to speak that we're struggling prior to falling over. If we're working in a chain gang, you only know when someone's unwell when they fall over. You know,
that's true.
So there's something of the ethos of a service which can allow people to speak, allow people to show some of their vulnerabilities, but also allow them to have support and not sink into their vulnerabilities. You have to have we do difficult work, so we do need teams around us that can help us do difficult things. I spoke of some difficult tasks in my previous incarnation as a child and youth mental health service. I could not have done those things without my team around me, you know. And they may not be in the room with me, but we've worked together and they help support very difficult conversations and events that I've had to be involved with. But it's not just on my shoulders. It can feel it at times, but I know that there's a whole host of people that have been part of me being able to do very important and difficult tasks. So I think we have to get that sort of leadership correct. I think it's bespoke. I think people knowing that they can speak to you is a very important thing as well. So it comes from leadership, but it comes from one's own personal approach too. And I guess that's, again, what we try to do, the VDHP, that that we try to get our names known as particular clinicians and try to have these sort of open, free-ranging conversations that aren't like lectures, but a more general discussion that others might listen to, they might agree, they might have other points, but I like to present it as a discussion where I haven't planned, I don't have a position statement to make on it, but we try to explore and come up with new ideas as we talk. Yeah, being open, each one of us being open, and there's lots of people who've put out different things about five ways to connect with a colleague, you know, at the car park, at the coffee machine, you know, and I think they're really useful ideas to remind us to be kind to each other. Don't be afraid to ask someone. I have a good colleague who I remember called me years ago. I was really touched that he called out of the blue to ask me how I was. You know, I was really, really pleased with that. And I still remember him and I still have thanked him for that years ago now. One phone call. And he wasn't my closest friend on the ward. But, you know, these little things are very important.
Yeah, the little things can often be some of the biggest, right? Just asking how someone is. Smiling at someone at work, teamwork as well. I think that's a huge thing. I think when I was an intern, I really thought everything was on my shoulders, you know, on the doctor's shoulders as an intern, which is not, it's interesting that was my mentality. But then as you progress, you realize it really is a team and it just relieves that load.
Absolutely. And you've got to work it as well. And it's really, The leadership have to make sure that our junior staff don't start to see it as on them. And I like to say it's not a private clinic. Where people have to know. So even simple things like emailing me to you about a patient, I would always like if three people were involved. So not only would I email yourself, but there might always be a second staff member. So that it's never one person's private sort of work to do. And I think we should sort of encourage that sense that it's not just one case manager or one doctor, but like you might email the intern and the SRMO at the same time. So they're both, everyone's in the loop together, and it's not just one person carrying that question. And there's someone else who's got a bit of oversight as well.
Yeah. And you realize how much people can help you when you do ask for help and you don't keep it all on yourself as well.
Oh, it's funny, that, isn't it? It's like, we're all doctors. So I went to see a rheumatologist about just some strange thing on my finger, and I thought I'd know everything that he'd say. You know, what am I going to learn? But it was just, no offense to rheumatologists, but, you think you know it because it's just a bit of Dupuytren's, so it's not much, Every Irish person's got that. But it was the small nuances and that really I didn't know, and that really opened up a lot of ideas for me. So it was very helpful. And I guess it's the same in psychiatry and mental health. People feel, what am I going to go at is seeing a psychologist or seeing a psychiatrist? I sort of know, and what do they know?
Yes.
But it's the small little things that often around the edges, the one percenters. I'm not a big football fan, but I still align one percenters. It's often the one percenters in one's own health or the knowledge that someone else might have or the help that we give someone that might make a big difference. Every now and again, it's a intervention that really helps, but a lot of the time clinically, it's the one percenters, particularly in mental health. If I expect every session to be gold, I wouldn't get paid much,
That's true. It reminds me of coaching. It's like you want every session to be transformational, but that's not really the case, right? It's a kind of small things over time adding to something that changes.
I think so, and I also like the idea that that at some stage the person themselves has to take an idea as transformational. Mm. You have to sort of turn it into something. It doesn't sort of happen automatically. It's like if you have a birthday, you have to actually do something to celebrate. It just doesn't happen automatically. You have to mark the event.
Mm.
And so turning one's life around, sometimes it is about marking an event and really investing into, okay, well, this will be something new that I will embark upon. Because it's easy in coaching or in therapy for people to take, to deflate the work they're doing. Oh, that wasn't much. I haven't got very far. That wasn't that useful. And we can do that as doctors about our own work with patients and et cetera.
Mm. Yeah,
or contribution to a team. We might know how much we contribute to a team.
Yeah, and sometimes people might say, I've never actually taken the time to ask myself how I feel. So for them, that's huge. But maybe for you, your mind is like, oh, that's small. So we all have different views.
Absolutely.
And I wanted to ask about well-being a little bit more, because it's a big word, and I think sometimes doctors just cover their ears after they hear well-being and mindfulness now, and you kind of tune it out. So what's something you could share just to help promote well-being?
I'm a cynic, which is a bit of a problem.
Okay.
I think I'm more cynical than most doctors. I struggled a lot with sort of pseudo aspects of staying well, and and you can hear them as having a certain sort of salesmanship aspect about it. But fundamentally, if you don't look after yourself, you will suffer.
Mm.
It isn't a game, and so we can hide behind, oh, these things are fluffy, or mindfulness is playing at things, and some people may, but actually you do have a physical body and a mind that you can wreck. You can wreck it. We know you can wreck it. So as doctors, we know we see patients who wreck their bodies and minds all the time. So maybe it's not that far-fetched to say, well, actually, perhaps you can future-proof certain aspects of your life. You can look after yourself. So, yeah, but I take your point that people often block their ears.
Yeah.
But we sit in front of patients who we can sense that they've been their own worst enemies sometimes. I'm not using it in a blaming way, hopefully, but we recognize that something of the paths they've taken, they may have done that a bit differently. You know, whether it's drinking or smoking or the way they've not looked after their income or their work and a lot of the people we see, it's unavoidable. You know, life can be very tough and there's no inoculation against tragedy in anyone's life. And no one could put their hand on their heart and say anything could happen to my family and I'd be okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's not true. So some things you can't guard against, but you can look after your health, I think. And you can find ways to make sure that you don't get isolated. And that you don't start to feel shameful about yourself and your abilities and your role that you've got with friends and family. Connections are really important to keep up. Absolutely. And so that's that's the major thing I would prescribe anyone is keeping up connections to others around us, that you're not isolated. You can't isolate yourself.
Yeah, that's so important because I think you can have that urge, like you said, to hide yourself and distance yourself from people when you're going through a hard time, but you need to do the opposite and that will start to help you come out of it. It also reminds me of there's a Quincy Jones documentary on Netflix and he says, prepare for the valleys in life because the hills take care of themselves, like the highs, you know, you can go through.
Yeah. It's like running a service. Someone once said to me, you've got to go, don't get too high with the highs or too low with the lows. I think you can get high with the highs. I'm not bad at it. I can't stop myself really. But, you know, but nevertheless, yes, you keep a certain equanimity. There's a certain sense of yourself that you have to keep even in the great times and a sense of oneself. So well-being, look, I think it is an interesting area. I recognize that some people can hear it as, well, what is it? And that's the question that person should ask themselves. What is well-being for me? Yeah. I reckon bespoke it. So the cynics like me, I have to say, well, what is my well-being? And I can recognize that there are times when I have not done myself a favor. On the other side, there are some fantastic resources on well-being. There's the work at Mayo Clinic, Stanford Clinic. I think their website is fantastic on well-being. And there's some great resources out there. And, you know, sometimes you have to also overemphasize some changes in order to make changes. If we just creep up on trying to change the medical way, the medical institutes operate, we'll be having the same podcast and in 10 years I'll be a bit older, but we'll be having the same. Yes, that's true, but I am concerned for you. I'm concerned for your world, but you know, we'll still be having the same conversation.
Mm.
So sometimes significant changes are made and then that flows through after time. We've seen that in a lot of, the attempt to for equality, for women getting into medicine, for women getting into high positions in hospital administration, that we've seen that major legislation changes has had to take place for that, and it's had a big effect. You know, we now have more women medical students for some years now, and that's slowly having an effect through training programs and colleges. But you know, I think there's a leadership there, to use that word again, to institute well-being, and so there'll be a significant change. And I know there are people at the health department who do take the idea of well-being quite important now. And so it's getting a sort of a bit of traction. How do we implement it in institutions politically and medically?
Yeah, and I hope it keeps changing. But you're right. I think it's, you know, individuals change the system, right? So it starts with ourselves.
Yeah, we can't wait. We sort of can't wait. So there's a little bit of both is needed. And I guess you sort of contribute where you can and where your interests lie. Yes. But we can't wait either to be kind and open and thoughtful to each other.
Yeah. I like that approach because I even heard someone say, "Oh, I missed the right time to have a pregnancy." You know, yeah. And it's like people are planning everything to the 9 months, and it's just, you know, how can you? It's impossible, yeah. Really, to live life like that.
Well, yeah. Well, Isabella, as you kindly offered to cut out a little bit that I said before, but you can put this bit in.
Yes.
We're talking about, you know, type A, and I'm promoting that we need a bit more type Z as well. We need to slow ourselves down and not just, you know, flog ourselves and think about taking time off. And as you say, to micromanage our lives, you'll come a cropper in some way. I think it is very difficult for planning a family or for those of our colleagues where that doesn't work out for them.
Yeah.
I think that's just as important absolutely essential for that particular person. And it's all that pressure and thought around that and the question of will I have a family or not, and seemingly trying to force it into one algebraic equation, and that they won't line up. But in some ways, we've all missed certain opportunities that we potentially could have had. I reckon I had enough energy in my 30s I had a lot of dad energy, which I wasted. I do have a child, but I had a lot of good energy, which I just wasted on stupid things in my 30s. And I reckon I regret that I didn't, to some degree, that I didn't have a couple more kids to torment and have fun with, you know. So, but you know, that's nothing of the heartache of someone who has tried and perhaps not been able to achieve having a child, if that's, or start a family, if that's what they're wanting. And medicine doesn't make that easy. And I know you were saying this before we started, that there was something for a lot of your colleagues that you come across and a lot who come to you for coaching, that there's something of that question for them about the timing of trying to start a family and will it work or won't it?
Yeah, and on that note, there is an episode on the podcast about family planning, and a fertility episode, if anyone wants to listen to it, with Dr. Violet Koo, a fertility specialist. And we just talk about, you know, when to freeze eggs, when not, because it's a big question for a lot of people, even in their 20s,
yeah.
About that. So it's really informational for anyone that's interested.
I mean, it's important information, isn't it? But it's also, you know, medicine gets in everywhere, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Medical technology, you know, and it's there's always a caution, isn't there, about, you know, that technology is there, that's true, but there's also one's desires and you've got to be very careful to plan those things carefully. I'm not an expert in that area, though, but it's just struck me how medicine even intrudes in that question.
Yeah, it does. It does. The reassuring thing from the episode was that because I think people think they should freeze eggs earlier than they need to.
Uh-huh.
And the end thing was you actually don't need to have that kind of fear of missing out as much as you think you do. So
yeah.
It was reassuring, actually. So no, you can be reassured, Patrick.
Yeah, you. Yeah. But I know you've seen quite a lot of doctors in your practice, in your coaching, who have had questions about family planning. So and I'm not sure if they necessarily seek you out now that people know that that's something that you've thought about, reflected upon, and But do you think that it's are you getting a representative sort of sample, or do you think it's a really pressing for most of your women colleagues?
I think it's just very pressing for all women, and not just medical professions. Yeah. I think since everyone is studying later, most jobs need a master's now, a lot of people need PhDs, everything's kind of getting pushed forward for when to have a family. So it's also like most of my friends who aren't even medical professions, medical professionals asking. So I think it's a big issue for women at the moment.
Yeah. I'm trying to turn the interview around, Isabella, onto
you. You're interviewing me now. I know. The tables have turned. What about well-being, you know, Stanford, the Mayo Clinic? What other resources or recommendations do you have for those listening to learn more about, you know, improving our well-being and our health?
Some of it is taking the expertosis out of it. You know, we sort of know what we need to do to care for ourselves. I mean, sleep is absolutely a crucial thing, and we all neglect sleep. You know, we all think I'll go to bed at 11 and then it's 11:45 by the time, and you think, oh, it's okay, it's not too late. But those sort of 45, 30 minutes, 50 minutes there through the whole week really add up. And actually you'll die of sleep deprivation before you die of starvation. And so there's something about sleep which gets under our guard, and we don't because you think, I can make it up tomorrow night. In fact, high-performance athletes know that they need three or four nights, really good sleep before their event, where punters like me will have a big Friday night and think I can go riding on Sunday and be fine.
Yeah.
a big Friday night, I have good sleep on Saturday, I'll be fine Sunday morning. But actually, you get through because you know it and it's not too bad and you're only just riding with friends. But you're not performing as well as you can, and that's with work as well. I mean, I'm so used to coming to work tired, and I know how to pace myself through the day. I have that extra coffee. I'll do this. I'll do that a bit slow. I'll leave that till tomorrow. There's all these ways that we undercut our well-being, and it's not just about performance. I mean, it's more about enjoying, because if I'm busy just trying to get through the day, I'm not going to enjoy it that much. You know, I'm not going to
survive.
And I won't be giving that vibe or that enjoyment to my colleagues when we're talking about a patient or thinking about a problem. It'll be more about, I'll be managing the situation and managing myself rather than being able to give something of an energy and I'm not being spooky here, but of a way of being present that is more present. And it's not I'm not talking about anything magical, but we all know, I think, when we're just sort of sleepwalking through a day or trying to do our best to keep our eyes open. You know? So sleep's important. We know for interns that a healthy diet's important. There was a great study where I think South Australia did it. I think Roger Sexton was involved, and they got all these medical students and they did blood tests and weights and took their diet when they started their internship.
Yes.
And then did it at the end. I like that one because everyone's health went down in terms of their diet. The healthy ones physically became less physically healthy. The only ones who improved were the couch potatoes, who got a bit fitter because they were running up and down stairs all the time.
Yes. Yeah.
But their diets were all crap. So, you know, there's all these little ways of looking after ourselves. Look, I think that the Stanford site is fantastic. I did they've got a free online course for people involved in medical well-being, and things run over 5 weeks, and I got to meet up with colleagues from different states in America and from Canada, and just the group discussions about what it's like to be an emergency doctor in Texas or a respiratory physician in Ontario. And you don't learn a lot of facts and figures that you can't pick up elsewhere, but it's sharing those collegial stories and recognizing that well-being is not just it's not just tinsel on the top of it. It's something very important. So your sleep, your diet, and I think friendships. So I don't go into telling people to read this and read that. I really think that you've got to find what suits you about looking after yourself, and you've got to enjoy something in your life. You've got to have an interest. I meet so many junior doctors who have no interests.
Yep.
And some who, and not that they, and some who have but have lost touch with it.
Yes.
And you've got to keep your threads to your interests. I found that very difficult as a junior doctor. I was very interested in literature and certain aspects of that, and I felt isolated from my love of certain literature, and I had to work at keeping that alive, and I often felt quite torn between medicine and other aspects that I was interested in. That was a real struggle through medical school, these other things that I, you know, a lot of us want to be Renaissance, good at everything.
That is true.
I ended up being hopeless at everything. Yes. Just a little bit.
Just a little, maybe a little bit above average at everything. How about that?
I'll come back on this podcast. Thank you. but some things have to be put aside. That's true. But it's important to keep a few loves going, you know, that you can enjoy.
And if it's like going to the gym, you know, or going for a run, you know, the anticipation is kind of the worst part. But then once you've done it, you feel so good. And it's same with your hobbies that you enjoy. You might be like, oh, I just want to lie on the couch. But when you actually make time for it, you're like, wow, I'm really glad I did that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it often, with any activity, it often takes 20 or 30 minutes before you forget that you've got to force yourself to get off the couch.
Yeah, exactly.
For the first 20 minutes, I'm asking myself, why the hell am I doing this? Yeah. What? I must be crazy. But then after that, I do a lot of cycling.
Okay.
Yeah. So the first 20 minutes, I think I'm absolutely mad. But then at the end of an hour, hour and a half, I'm buzzing, and it carries through for the rest of the week. And, you know, I can – and it also gives friendship and enjoyment and stories, which is the stuff of life, the small stories. They don't have to be great adventures. They can be little tales of things that have happened along the way.
Yeah, you're right. And I think we all know what contributes theoretically to our physical wellness, you know, sleep and diet. We've all heard that.
Yeah.
But it's incorporating what works for you and making it work for your time.
I've got one other little point on that. I've thought a bit about that because there's also a lot of depressed athletes. So so physical fitness is important, but, you know, we also want to be, you know, well-rounded is a funny term. Doctors want to be knowledgeable as well. We like having knowledge. I don't just want to be a fit doctor, you know. I want to end up being wise and knowledgeable. But they're sort of dirty words. We can talk about staying fit, but what about being a doctor who is grounded in their knowledge and has gained some wisdom, whatever that crazy thing might be? You know, I suspect a lot of us go into medicine because it's got something of the body, but it's also got something of knowledge.
Mm.
And patients come to us thinking that we know things. I never let on that I don't. That's the beauty of being a psychiatrist. You can just go, tell me more.
Yeah. See,
other doctors have to actually say something. And I just nod and say, that's tough. But that's a joke. But, you know, so what about reading? What about reflecting on the experiences you've had? That's where we get to supervision and coaching. Gleaning off a tiny bit of what we've been through that we can work in other ways. And it just doesn't always have to be sort of statistical research. There are other ways we can write about it. We can think about it. We can talk about it. We can get coaching about it. It's taking off a little bit of what we've been through and making wisdom out of it in some way. And that's what we don't do for our junior doctors. They're just moving on. And if they glean any wisdom, it's luck because they're in a survival mode. So I think supervision is a really important thing. I've continued to have a supervisor right through my career. I still sometimes wonder about it on a Friday. I think, oh, my God. So I'm glad that Zoom is very common these days. It saved me. But when I meet other doctors, I think, gee, I'm really glad I've done that, that it's enabled me to think about all those experiences that I've had over through my journey. And I've supervised a lot of doctors now too myself, and I think it's what you're doing is fantastic. And I think that sort of coaching supervision really needs to be much more a general accepted part of the medical world.
Yeah, and I think it is changing, and I hope it just continues to grow. There's now a group of doctors who coach doctors in Australia that's just started. Yeah. And when you said the professional athletes know when to sleep, it just made me think I've thought about that about doctors. You know, it's a very high-paced profession, and if we kind of thought of it almost like how professional athletes take care of their minds and bodies, you know, doctors getting coaches, doctors having good meals and sleep, I think that would be a great basis for coming at such a difficult profession.
And not just so you perform well, though, not just so that you perform well, where the athlete may be so they can perform well, there has to be that aspect so that you enjoy your life, that you're well in your life, and that you're, and as doctors, if we do, in a sense, privileged knowledge as having something to it, then why don't we work on taking something from our experiences and growing from that in some ways and reflecting on that. Yeah. And I think maybe that doesn't happen automatically. I think you have to work at these things. I remember, you know, I have vague memories of being an intern and a JRMO where, you know, event after event after event in one day. And I used to think, gee, if any of my non-medical friends had one of these things happen in a year, they'd be dining out on it.
Exactly, yes.
I've had no chance. Some of them are really hard little tragedies and snapshot tragedies. You're invited into someone's life for a short period and then you don't cross their path again. Mm-hmm. Somehow where does that go?
Yeah,
I do meet some emergency doctors, some very senior ones who speak of, you know, after all these years, I suddenly realize it has left little scars on my back.
Mm.
And I feel that from my work in psychiatry, that I haven't got away scot-free. I don't think anyone does. I think there's a little price to pay for the demands that are made upon doctors. But, you know, it's it doesn't have to tip into being unwell, and some of it we can take and give to colleagues like we're doing now.
Yes.
You know, this is what this is about. This is my own therapy. Thank you, Isabella.
You're welcome. I'll send you the invoice once we finish. Now I like to ask this of people, just a bit of a meta view and going back in time, what would you say to your intern self if you could speak to him right now?
Cut your hair. You know, I was really so scruffy. I was the scruffiest, irritable intern you could ever meet. I dragged myself around. I would have said, for me, my medical career has got better as I've gone along. You know, I found it very difficult as a medical student, and it's actually I've recognised now that I've got a lot out of it, but it took me a long time to recognise that experience of being able to speak to people and hear stories and partake in their lives for short periods. I would have tried to reassure myself that that you were doing a good job and that. You know, that you would get somewhere one day and in a way that you would fulfill something of your abilities, you know, And that's an important thing. You know, there's not ambition with the capital A, but the small A ones, and one wants to make something of one's world. And so I would have reassured Patrick back then that you may be scruffy, but you'll be okay.
You'll get there.
Yeah, you'll find a path forward. Take the opportunities.
Yeah, I love that. Thanks for sharing. Now I also what were you going to say?
No. I'm working my regrets in this interview already, Isabella. So now I'm just.
No, it's been great. I have another question that is of everyone has their own view of this. What is balance to you?
Oh, I wish you'd told me about this one. I think of balance as an impossible task that you have to do. it's like being on a tightrope. Balance is not a static thing. You're on a tightrope, you're walking. So yes. That's the only aspect that I add to balance, is that it's not a static thing, actually, and it's not just that side. It's a momentum. You've got to keep your momentum to keep balance. Mm. Tightrope walkers have to keep moving.
Yeah.
You've got to keep your momentum to keep your balance. And that, so it's never achieved because it's in time. And you've got to step into time, whatever that might mean, and go with that. You can't micromanage, you can't parcel time away, you can't find the time. You've got to make it.
Yeah.
I'll find time on the weekend. It's not going to happen. I'll make 10 o'clock on Saturday morning to catch up with my friend. Yeah. So balance needs to us to add in that component of momentum and making time for things in our life and not trying to find it. Where did I put that time? Was it under the couch?
Yes.
Where did I put it?
That's so true.
I lose everything else. I lose my keys. I lose my wallet. And I've lost a lot of time.
Yeah.
But you've got to keep on going forth. Yeah.
Yeah. I relate to that, losing things. But you're carving out the time, as people say, blocking out that day in the calendar.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so that I'd add that to balance. Balance is not a static thing. It's something we've got to sort of give to ourselves by making time, by carving out, as you put it nicely.
Yeah. Now, is there anything else you'd like to add that you think would benefit the listeners?
Any resemblance to myself is purely fictional. No, I don't know, Isabella. I think that's I'd love to come and speak again.
Yeah, anytime.
There's just so much to talk about. It's a big topic, and you know, your questions have provoked a lot of thinking for me, and I hope I've done okay for the listeners and yourself, just off the cuff, in that fashion.
That's been great, and thank you for your time. I know you're busy. I know you're doing Type Z. But I'm sure Type Z is still busy, given all what you do. How can people find Doctors Health for their state and reach out if they would like to reach out or help in any way?
Yeah. Each state has a Doctors Health service, and each of them has a website. So you can just put in Doctors Health and go to your website. There's the Doctors Health Alliance, which is a relatively new group set up by the state doctor's services. And there's the sort of organisational federal body, Doctors for Doctors, which have our phone numbers on their website. So there's a number of avenues to find that online. I'm very happy to hear from anyone from Victoria and even interstate if they want to give us a call. Any inquiries, always welcome.
Thank you for that. I'll put all those links in the show notes below. And thank you again for coming on. It's been really great to chat about this. I know it's a tough topic, but we also, I feel, made some light of all well-being and enjoying things.
Yeah, I'm going to, you know, it's important to take it serious but not be grim.
Yes.
I trot that line out a lot because I think it's actually true. Even with our patients, we take their question serious, but we can't afford to be grim. And in this space too, it's serious, but we need to be able to speak about it and not hide from it.
Yeah. That's a really good line, to be serious but not grim.
You've been listening to the Balance Medics Handover Podcast. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, I'd love for you to take a minute to rate and review this podcast and click the follow button. For more resources, check out the Balance Medics website. The link to this will be in the show notes below. See you next episode.